I will call the remote meeting hearing of the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee to order. Today is January 14th, 2021. This meeting is held in accordance with Rule 10.01, which was passed and allows for remote hearings. All remote hearings are recorded and live streamed by House Public Information. The clerk will take the roll, attendance by the roll. Adam?
All right. Hansen, Rick.
Hansen, Rick, present.
Hansen, present. Wasliwick, Amy.
Wasliwick, present.
Wasliwick, present. Heinzeman, Josh.
Can you see if there's a...
Heinzeman, Josh.
Yeah.
Acomb, Patty.
Acomb, present.
Acomb, present. Acklin, Susan.
Acklin, present.
Acklin, present. Backer, Jeff.
Backer, present.
Backer, present. Becker Finn, Jamie.
Becker Finn, present.
Becker Finn, present. Eklund, Rob.
Eklund, Thompson Township, present.
Eklund, present. Fisher, Peter.
Fisher, present.
Fisher, present. Green, Steve.
Green, present.
Green, present. Igo, Spencer.
Igo, present.
Igo, present. Jordan, Sydney.
Jordan, present.
Jordan, present. Keeler, Heather.
Keeler, present.
Keeler, present. Lee, Fu.
Lee, present.
Lee, present. Lippert, Todd.
Lippert, present.
Lippert, present. Lewick, Dale.
Representative Lewick is excused.
Lewick, excused. Morrison, Kelly.
Morrison, present.
Morrison, present. Nelson, Nathan.
Present.
Nelson, present. Tice, Tama.
Tice, present.
Tice, present. Heinzeman, Josh. Heinzeman, Josh. And thus concludes the roll.
Members, of quorum is present. The next item on the agenda is the minutes for Tuesday, January 12th, 2021. Representative Lee, have you reviewed the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have reviewed the minutes and I move the minutes.
Representative Lee moves the minutes for January 12th, 2021. We can take this vote as a voice vote. All those in favor say aye.
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 The minutes are approved. Members, this morning we're going to hear, this committee has a number of agencies under its purview relating to their budgets and their efforts. So we are going to start with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. At the last meeting, we talked about the number of acronyms that are involved. And so the first one is Bowser. And so John Janeski and Angie Becker-Kadelka are going to be presenting a bit. You did have materials sent out earlier, so you would be able to ask some questions. And those materials have also been posted on the committee website. So with that, take it away. And please state your name and who you're with for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John Jasky, Executive Director with the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources, or Bowser, as the chair indicated. Thank you for the opportunity to converse with you this afternoon. As the chair mentioned, we provided to staff, and I'm sure staff provided to all of you, more of a complete overview, like we probably would have done if we were sitting in person and trying to walk through a more detailed presentation of our agency's programs, mission, and the way we operate. However, you know, you have the material. You can certainly get a hold of me anytime, or Angie as well. We're working, like many of you, you know, sitting here in a spare built a room in our own home, and it's been working just fine, actually. You know, most of the things that we were commissioned to do by statute and otherwise have been accomplished even during this COVID period. And certainly can take some questions around that too, if you'd like. But what I'd like to do is just give a very brief overview, and then the detailed presentation that you have in your hands, you know, you can refer to that as a reference piece. So with that, just our agency is, you know, operates a little bit differently than others. Everything else, once you get past that structural piece, is actually the same. You know, we operate with the same authorities that are passed to us by legislation, you know, either regulatory programs or incentive programs, and all of our administration is done under the direction, of course, of the governor and the executive branch. Our structure is a little bit different in that, and rather than having a commissioner, the agency has a board of directors that's appointed by the governor. That also includes the commissioners of DNR, agriculture, pollution control, health, and then University of Minnesota Extension is also on the board, along with the representatives of watershed districts, counties, cities, townships, soil and water conservation districts, and three citizens. So it's a group of 20 that is a board of directors for the organization. And I, as the executive director, am then accountable to the board. And of course, we're all accountable, you know, through the executive branch to the governor. We have a small staff, at least in comparison to some others, about 120 staff. The reason for that is that all of our programs are designed and carried out through local governments. And I mentioned, you know, some of them already, the counties, watershed districts, soil and water conservation districts, the cities, and even some townships that do conservation work. The focus of our work is different than, you know, for example, the DNR is responsible for all of the public lands that the state holds, at least the state held lands largely. You know, of course, counties manage a bunch of properties as well. And we know that the federal government has a large number of land holdings, especially in northern Minnesota, those public lands. But we work with private lands, with, you know, landowners to provide public benefits of clean water and wildlife habitat, climate benefits as well. And so those are things that are done by landowner relationships, and that's best achieved by having somebody local who's knowledgeable and experienced, and most importantly, trusted to work with to accomplish those projects and practices on their property. This map on the left here, I'll try to show that to you real quick. Just one of the maps that might work here if I can show this screen. It shows the private lands of Minnesota in gold, if you can see that. It also is overlain with the waters of the state that are impaired, which means, of course, they've been polluted to a point where they need to be improved. Not coincidentally, you know, where we have our greatest amount of public lands, we have, you know, the cleaner water too, right? Because there's less things on that land that can contribute to water pollution. And so it's critical that we spend a great deal of our attention on those private lands through the local government delivery system. Our budget, just briefly, you know, is really driven by this pie chart, and the Clean Water Fund, you know, as part of the legacy amendment, is as well as the Outdoor Heritage Fund, make up, you know, more than half of that. And of course, that goes through another committee, most of that decision making, but it relates right back to the authorities that we use to carry out those duties that come through this committee's, particularly as policy responsibilities. So the next thing I'll show you, if I could show one more little picture here, let me see if I can make this work. We do have a regulatory component to our work. And again, that is similarly carried out by local governments, you know, the local planning and zoning offices, or water districts with their rulemaking, and soil and water conservation districts with their responsibilities for technical assistance. All of that, you know, folds into these programs. Wetland protection, drainage, some other things, but I'll highlight just one of them here, and that's the buffer law that is you know, here, this map shows some progress over time, going back to, you know, the last 3 or 4 years, we've seen a great deal of additional compliance that's occurred. I guess people can't quite see my screen. So let me see if I can, hopefully you can see it now. This shows the status of the buffer compliance from, you know, past 3 years. Fortunately, we had a good year this year in terms of weather, both in the spring and fall, to, you know, get many more of those properties up to compliance. Again, that's through the local offices, the watershed districts, and counties do the enforcement, and the soil and water conservation districts do the technical assistance to help landowners get to compliance. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Angie Becker-Kadelka, Assistant Director, for a couple more things that she can provide more on the voluntary side. Angie?
Thanks, John. Thank you, Representative Angie Becker-Kadelka, Assistant Director with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. Mr. Chair and members, as Director Jasky said, the work that we do is driven by a local conservation delivery system. And that means that Bowser's work is delivered through the local soil and water districts, watershed districts, water management organizations, and counties. And we know that landowners have options. So in voluntary conservation delivery, we work closely with our local government partners to make sure that they have resources, training, technical assistance to help landowners make the best choices that work for those landowners and for their land. And there's a continuum there. There's a continuum of what programs look like, what assistance looks like, how much, how long. And so one of those that we'd like to highlight this afternoon is the Minnesota CREP partnership. So Minnesota CREP is the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program. It is a partnership with the federal U.S. Department of Agriculture. And so it's taking the federal Conservation Reserve Program and marrying it up with the state Reinvest in Minnesota RIM program. So it's marrying up the federal program with the state easement program. It's in 54 counties. You'll see there in the map. We started this back in 2015, and the idea was, is how can we get some of those federal resources and dollars into Minnesota for the most environmentally sensitive land that landowners maybe aren't getting a good crop or good yield on, that we pay for once for a public benefit, and then it stays in that protection mode. So it's targeted to just three practices. It's buffers, it's wetlands, and it's wellhead protection. So it's those areas where there might be public drinking water under the ground. It's protecting the ground on top of that. And so the public benefits include things like keeping soil on the land out of the water, providing places to temporarily store water, protecting vulnerable drinking water, and then enhancing wildlife habitat and grasslands. So we have to date, we have over 31,000 acres enrolled in this program. The state legislature was proactive. So even before this agreement was signed, the state legislature decided to show the commitment that Minnesota had to get these federal dollars into the state. And we are now down to our last $15.5 million that has been, you know, compiled since 2015. And that will more than double and match what the federal government brings out, and the federal government payments, 100% of it goes directly into the community as payments to landowners.
Ms. Becker-Kadelka, we do have a question from Representative Fisher. We could wait until you guys are done and then go to them. Would that be better? So,
Mr. Chair, sure. And I think we just have two more slides left. So if that's what you'd prefer, I can finish those up.
Why don't we wait and then go to that and remind members that under participants or reactions, you can raise your hand and we'll be checking to make sure we call on everybody. So proceed, Ms. Becker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Another part of local conservation delivery is around water planning, and water planning is evolving in the state of Minnesota, where 25 years ago, we would plan based on political boundaries, like counties, and we would plan what our water management looked like, but that isn't the way that water flows. So the planning has evolved as a result of the work of the Local Government Water Roundtable over the last 6 years to look at watershed boundaries. And this includes what are the biggest concerns around protection and restoration, what are the biggest goals, and then how do we have, if you hear the phrase one watershed, one plan, how do we have a unified approach to what those priorities are locally and implementing them? From there, that logical progression then is how do we fund that plan? And so funding the plan as opposed to funding each specific project helps to streamline the process. It makes delivery more effective and more efficient. It's so that local governments aren't always trying to take time and resources in competition with each other across the state for applying for practices and projects, you know, practice by practice or project by project. It makes predictable funding, so that means funding is consistent. and it's known. So instead of having to wait for a grant announcement, a local government will know what's available, and then they can respond more quickly to landowner interest and to resource needs. And then it's more equitable. So plan priorities are funded across the state, and we realize that there's really important goals around protection and protecting, especially, you know, in our Northern Lakes region, just as much as there's really important goals around restoration and making sure that we can either stop something, a river or stream or lake from becoming impaired, or help one with that was impaired get delisted. So here's an example, targeting conservation. So Sand Creek Watershed is in Scott County. Bowser awarded this watershed a $2 million Clean Water Fund grant to the Scott Watershed Management Organization as part of a watershed program. And so what this group did with local governments working with landowners and partners is really take a look at what are the priorities needed to help clean up Sand Creek. Sand Creek was impaired, an impaired water body. And so they have specific projects that included specific riparian improvement projects that were coordinated by Great River Greening. There was a targeted in-lake phosphorus reduction. There was cover crops and nutrient management. And what happened was there was a 20% reduction in the amount of sediment that made it into Sand Creek. And the phosphorus reduction in two of the lakes are that were currently impaired for recreation are now on track to have those lakes be delisted or taken off the impaired waters list. So this is an example of one, and I think in your slideshow or PowerPoint, there's lots of other examples. Feel free if you want to follow up afterwards too with questions on those across the state of how these funds are used. And then the last thing we'll quick talk about is wrap up with a conversation on climate.
Thanks, Angie. And members, if you want to have some examples of those types of projects that she just described that are happening in your district or in places that you are familiar with, we can certainly, you know, bring some of the information to you, because there are many, many, many of them, and of course, many, many more needed and to come. So depending on the landscape and the resource concerns, there's a practice that can pretty much solve every problem. And then the work we've done to identify the places that we can do the most good has been really important too, and you'll hear more about that in the future. Just a couple more things. There was some work done by the administration and the agencies, and I'm just going to introduce one little slice of this regarding climate adaptation and mitigation. And of course, this is things that we've been spending some time doing already and trying to, of course, manage, in the case of water, the amount of water that we're now receiving, both in terms of volume and intensity, that's increased over the last few decades at least. And we also have to manage the infrastructure that water flows through. And you can imagine in developed areas, urban areas, suburban areas, there's a lot of water that moves off of impervious surfaces. In rural areas, we have water that moves off the landscape into ditches and tile lines and so forth. And of course, in some places where the land has been, unaltered, we have pretty good water quality. Water that's going through those systems is, manageable. But we have to continue with that. As Angie said, we have to sustain those quality forests and riparian areas too, even where we have good water quality. So there's a few things that have been identified as we call it the natural and working lands part of the climate issue, and this will also be something that is common to some other agencies that you're going to hear from, Department of Natural Resources, Pollution Control, and of course, if those of you who may be on the Ag Committee, Department of Agriculture also is involved in all of this. And so many of you are very much aware of even a larger suite of climate issues surrounding energy and transportation and so forth, but this is just one sliver of that. So we need to hold more water on the land. Holding it closest to where it lands or where the snow melts is almost always the best. We can't always do that. Sometimes we have to also open up floodplains to allow more water to get through without causing harm. But the best way to do it is to hold the water close to where it starts by, impounding it. In the case of this structure, you can see there's it's been established, a wetland restored. You get some habitat benefits, of course, too, so you get more than one thing, but you have to pick the right places and make sure that they're most cost-effective and acquire the proper land rights and then accomplish the design and so forth. So these projects are really important, and some of them are part of the CREP initiative, which Angie talked about earlier, but there's a lot more of them that are needed in many more places. We also know that plants, of course, are critical to holding carbon in the plant material that the earth then holds instead of releases. And so we have, you know, kind of two simple practices that are used in that regard, or that can be amplified and extended into more areas potentially, for sure, on the soil health piece. Trees and shrubs, of course, are a great way to do that. They also provide, you know, potential benefits for long-term even harvesting, but it has a water quality benefit in some cases. If it's planted next to a river, for example, a riparian buffer, we have windbreaks that can help provide energy protection or snow and safety issues, you know, wind prevented from blowing across roads. So putting these types of practices in places that they can do more than one benefit is also something that we think is important to consider. And we have local governments ready to do that in all of these programs, and they are doing that already. Soil health is, you know, a big part of our future in Minnesota. We have you know, 20, 25 million acres of agricultural land that's important to, you know, of course, feed ourselves, feed the world, and provide energy. But it also is an area where if we can put more land into a less or no-till scenario and or plant cover crops, as they're often called, so we have a green cover on that land so it's not bare during the most vulnerable times of the year, typically in the fall and spring when we have a lot of, as Angie described, you know, potential for runoff to bring the soil from the place that needs to be on the field to a place we don't want it, which is in the water. So these practices also provide more than one benefit, but if they're done right, and it's important how they're done, they can also provide an important carbon sequestration benefit. So, Mr. Chairman, that's a very brief overview of just a few things that are happening in our agency, and we'd be happy to have any questions or have some more conversation around them.
Very good. We've got several questions. I'm going to go with Representative Fisher first, and then Representative Morrison, and then Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. I appreciate the opportunity, and thank you to our presenters for the presentation today. One of the things I had a question on was back on the map showing the compliance with the buffer law between the years. And I have a couple questions here. The first one has to do with, as I take a look at the map and the buffer law, I know this is something that was rolled out under the Dayton administration. We're now in the third year of the Walz administration, and I'm a little concerned that we still have some counties that have some issues out there and not the buffer carryout. And I was kind of wondering what is happening, why is it taking so long for compliance in certain parts of the state?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Fisher. You know, it's there's a couple short versions of an answer, I guess, but I will say that every site is unique, you know, into itself. You know, I will say the last year, a couple of years prior, we had some terrible weather conditions, but setting that aside, the places where we still have a little bit more work to do, and there are parcels that need attention, and most of them are, as we can best describe it, in a status of being achieved through a public drainage system buffer installation. That's why you see the ones that are still needing some attention are up in the Red River Valley. There's one or two counties there, maybe one county in western Minnesota. I don't have a map in front of me anymore, but those counties have a great deal of public drainage systems, and they go through a process to acquire the buffer on behalf of the ditch authority rather than requiring the individual landowners to put it in. And so the law allowed the landowners who are subject to those public drainage proceedings to wait and have the ditch system install the buffer on their behalf. That's one response to your question. The rest of it would have to be kind of a case-by-case evaluation. And we will have a summary of that. We normally would have had it in January. We're going to give a little bit more time because of the delays on people's work due to COVID, but we're going to have a summary that we can prepare for you and share with you. I think about March is when we expect to have that this year.
Senator Fisher?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a follow-up question. I do appreciate that some counties are going a little differently how they are rolling it out, and I'm hoping that they will be able to wrap that up very soon. The other question comes in as to ongoing compliance. I know that with the prices of corn and soybeans jumping up to very substantial highs these days, there may be some people who are taking a look that they may want to try to get as much of their land in productive use again versus where they have been. I'm wondering, how does ongoing compliance go in terms of checking up how often that occurs, and how are we dealing with people who are not complying with the buffer law?
Yeah, thank you. Good questions, all of them. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the compliance is specified in the statute. In essence, it says that the Stormwater Conservation District does the technical inspections, and they do that on a regular basis. And there's a, as you remind us, you know, this is not a one and done thing. You do it, and then you have to keep monitoring the compliance, you know, every year, right? Because every year is a new opportunity to, you know, trim a little off the buffer or worse, I suppose. But we've seen, you know, really good compliance. And I have to say, you know, that the farmers that have put these buffers in have done so in a 98% clip, which is fantastic, right? And some of them have been able to use that buffer for hay and some other potential benefits too, while providing, you know, the water quality benefits. So we want to acknowledge that first. The process that they do use if a compliance action is taken is there's either an administrative penalty order, which a local government and or the state can exercise in some cases where needed. Those steps are being taken, you know, one by one, case by case, site by site, methodically, to make sure we're running it like we do many other local land use programs. Again, they're very familiar with this in the planning and zoning offices, for example, and they're taking those steps, you know, one at a time.
Follow up, or we'd like to get going.
Very quickly, I'll mention is thank you, Mr. Chair. Is I realize that the vast majority of farmers are doing the correct thing. I want to make sure that those that aren't, that we have a process so that some people who aren't are being held to the standards that everybody else decided to follow on their own basis. So thank you,
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was hoping that Assistant Director Becker Kadelka could comment on how pollinator habitat is incorporated into Bowser's plan.
Mr. Chair,
Ms. Becker Kadelka. Yep.
Representative Morrison, thank you. Good question. So one activity that Bowser has recently embarked upon has been funded through the Environment and Natural Resource Trust Fund. And Representative Morrison has been a key lead on some of this legislation and figuring out how not only in our rural areas, like in the Minnesota CREP, for example, where we can plant pollinators on land that is permanently protected, how can we also look at creating corridors in urban areas? And we know that there are pollinators that are threatened or endangered species, and that urban areas are important places also where we create corridors. So one program is called the Lawns to Legumes program. I do believe that is in one of your slides in the PowerPoint presentation. We have been working with local governments and Metro Blooms to train landowners and residents of the state in how to adapt small plantings in their yards to build pollinator habitat. As a result of this, we also have a very small grant program to help with the labor and the seed and the plants for some of this. And so these are grants of $150 to $300, but are very meaningful for folks that otherwise wouldn't be able to do this. Right now, we have had over 7,000 applications for this program. We've been able to fund about 1 in 10 of the applications for it over the last 16 months. And what we found is that there has been a really, I would say, almost a renewed community interest in this as well. We have demonstration neighborhoods where we're looking at more than just individual by individual. We're looking at corridors. And I actually saw a slide just yesterday that showed how right now there's still a lot left to be done, but there are these small corridors that are starting to form in urban areas where people have done these plantings.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you so much.
Representative Lippert, and then Green, and then Heintzman, and then Backer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Jashke. I have a question about cover crops. So I've been hearing positive things about cover crops from many different directions. Farmers are excited about using cover crops when they're when they're utilizing them, or farmers are interested in integrating them into their landscape. I know some states like Maryland and Indiana have a very high percentage of cover crop usage on farmland. Maryland's over 50%, Indiana's like in the 40s. Wondering if you can say more about where Minnesota is in comparison, how your cover crop program works right now, and then what would help us move forward as a state to get more cover crops in use.
Director Jaschke.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Lippert, yes, several questions. First of all, you know, Minnesota's, you know, I guess a pace of adoption is, the good news is increasing. I think the latest statistics that the U.S. Department of Agriculture had showed a 35% increase, but of course it was, you know, we're still under 5% in terms of total landscape that's, you know, in that category of incorporating this soil health or the cover crop practice specifically. But a couple things we're doing. One, you know, and reasons for that are varied. You know, obviously, you know, having funding available to get them started is a critical part of that. You know, USDA has had some of that funding over the years, but it's come and gone. We created last biennium, I guess it would be, I can't exactly give you the date, a demonstration program to use a cover crop practice we actually had a great deal of demand for it. We had 18 soil and water checks apply and only had enough money for 5, but they had a great deal of interest from landowners. And I think people have come to understand, not only is it a benefit for the conservation, you know, that the public gets out of it, you know, the carbon sequestration and water quality, but if it's done right over a long enough period of time, it actually, because that soil organic matter increases, it gets to be a production benefit. You know, the crop actually utilizes the soil nutrients much better. It also provides an energy saving benefit and an emissions benefit because you don't have as many passes over the field, for example, right, with equipment. But the challenge that some have raised, you know, Minnesota's got a climate that's more northerly than the places where these practices have been started, you know, a more central part of the country. A few years ago, we worked at the university to create the Minnesota Office for Soil Health, and that office is set up for the very purpose of bringing applied research to Minnesota's ag producers in the soil health arena. And that has gotten going now, and I think we'll be seeing much more of that. University of Minnesota Extension also is an important player in this and communicating to producers how this works, because like any of us maybe, but for farmers for sure, you know, seeing is believing, and hearing it from somebody who is one of their peers and has made it work is sometimes the very, very best way to get people to try something and take it on for themselves.
Representative Lippert, follow up?
Thank you, Director Jaschke. That's all for now. Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the folks for being here today to answer some questions. I did want to touch on just a couple things before I ask my questions, and I will be brief as I can. The one thing, you know, some of the stuff that was mentioned here today, and one was the fact that you look for marginal lands, and I've got a number of farmers in my district and around me who would question that the land that's being kind of overtaken here in some of these areas is marginal. In fact, some of it is very good farmland. And so I think that we'll be touching on that through this session, on our committee meetings. The other is with the watersheds, there's an issue with the eminent domain that we're gonna try to deal with this year if possible, because we have folks that now don't wish to sell their property, and watershed districts, as you may or may not know, are not elected, they're appointed. And yet they have the authority to levy taxes and in some cases use eminent domain to take property. And so we're looking at ways that we can restructure those watershed districts to make that more of a county run board, so that the people that's serving on that watershed district with all this authority are actually elected instead of appointed. But the other thing is, with the One Watershed, One Plan, I do know that we have some counties in my district that are actually pushing back on some of these plans, and they don't like them, and they're looking for more authority to restructure or have more input on the One Watershed, One Plan. So I'd like to ask if you could give us a broad overview of the One Watershed, One Plan is for the, especially for the new members, so they know what you're talking about.
Director Jaschke.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Green. There is some material in the handout that we provided that helps, I think, with a little bit of that. And certainly there, you know, you can, there's a statute that actually, you know, guides that. It's Minnesota Statute 103B.801, and you can read that on your own time, of course. But it's a voluntary program, first and foremost, right? There is not a mandate to do it, but as Ms. Becker-Kadelka indicated earlier, the idea of using a watershed approach to manage our water is one that we believe, and I think many others have also come to believe and are working towards, a, you know, the best way to do that, right? The water flows across, you know, geopolitical boundaries in almost every instance. And so we need to be able to work together as local governments and other partners in that work. The science, of course, that we use to just, you know, to guide that is also watershed driven. And that's, you know, another reason why the watershed approach works the best. You know, I would say actually we've been doing watershed work for a very long time. You think about some of the drainage systems that were built, you know, 125 years ago. They literally were defined by a watershed boundary as to who was going to be benefiting and who was going to pay and how much they were going to pay. So we've had a, in some form of a watershed approach for a very long time. The metro area, there's a watershed mandate that was, you know, put into law in the 1980s, right, and is one of the leading approaches across the country in how to do that well, not only for our natural landscapes, but for our built landscapes too, right? The water still needs to flow, whether it's going through a pond, a pipe, or, you know, naturally across the landscape into a river or a creek. But the general idea, Representative Green, is that we work with the multiple local governments that are existing in the area using their existing authorities. They get no new authority. They just put their authorities and their best information and ideas together and their funding ultimately to do the work that will improve the water quality or protect it where it's already good.
Representative Green.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director. I don't know if you really gave us a good answer on that. I do kind of understand the One Watershed, One Plan, and to simplify it more, it basically stretches across the counties, and one of the things that the counties are concerned about is any, if they do not participate in the One Watershed, One Plan, is there any movement on the part of Bowser to withhold funding from them for projects?
Director Jaschke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, no, there is, it's again, it's a voluntary participation. Of course, they, speaking specifically of counties, you know, have had a water planning authority in the statute since 1989, I believe, and they're in this case, choosing to go this route with a watershed approach in lieu of that. They still have the option to continue the county-by-county approach. But we do believe it, and I think they do too. I mean, the counties were one of the most important early adopters of this watershed approach because, of course, they had the most maybe change to make too, you know, and so I want to give them a lot of credit for thinking about that and thinking about it in a forward direction. And a lot of times it is harder to work together, but if you can work together better, you're going to get an outcome that's going to be multiple times greater than just trying to do your own thing in your own area. So if we have some troubles, and that certainly can be the case, you know, sometimes we have people that are either, you know, not quite understanding or don't agree with something, and that's perfectly fine. It's an opportunity to do it voluntarily. There is no mandate. And if we can be helpful, and we want to be helpful only when needed, because we believe the local governments can do this largely all by themselves, that's what we expect to get out of this.
Senator Green.
That's all for now. I think that we'll be discussing this over the course of the year. So I will, I'll end there and let other people ask their questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Heinzman, you were there with a hand, but now I don't see it. Did you want to?
I didn't take my hand down, but when my internet crashed a minute ago, the hand came down, I guess.
Okay.
You hear me okay? I do have a couple of comments and then a question for Director Jaschke. My comments would start with an observation, some of the other comments that have been made, and I don't mean to disparage them at all, but I do think it's important to point out that when we're talking about compliance in the vast majority of the state that's on track when we're talking about the buffer law, and the few that are not, it's, I think, really important to point out how well we're doing. And when comments are being made about our friends in agriculture who are doing the right thing, the implication, of course, is that there are those that just aren't. And I don't think that's a necessarily a fair characterization of those folks that aren't in full compliance as we're talking about a program like this. And I just want to point that out, that it should be a process where the state is working with agriculture. And in some cases, I think there are examples where the state is wrong or has been wrong, and we have to work through those problems with our friends in agriculture. My question, Director Jaski, would be around the budget. We do have a lot of new members on the committee, as Representative Green pointed out with his question. And it'd be nice to get kind of a walkthrough, just briefly, of sources of revenues for the agency, for Bowser, and then how some of those dollars are spent. That would be, I think, helpful for the committee.
Director Jaski, and maybe you want to put that pie chart up again. We will continue with Bowser until 2 o'clock. I know we've got Representative Backer, Representative Lee, too. So thank you, Representative Heinzman, Director Jaski.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Heinzman, members. Maybe Ms. Becker could, if you could put that pie chart back up, and I'm going to let you actually answer this question after I just make one point that, you know, was, I think, in the detail of the handout that we provided to you, that all of the funding that comes to Bowser, of that amount in total, you know, goes across the board, 83% of it, I believe, is the number in the most recent tabulation, goes to local governments for their work, right? That's why, you know, our budget is, you know, larger than it would be proportionally to the number of staff we have, right? Because the money goes through the agency to local governments to do their projects, to, you know, to help landowners get those projects and practices accomplished, right? So these are the sources on the screen here, and I'll turn it over to Ms. Becker-Kadelka to provide a little bit more background on that.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So, yeah, so as Director Jaski said, overall, the agency has 17% of our budget goes towards programs, program development, oversight and accountability operations. And then the other 83% is out the door to our local government partners for this work. So you'll see Clean Water Fund makes up over 50% of just under 50% of our budget now. The general fund is somewhere around 17%. Of course, bonding, it depends on what the bonding year is. And then the other sliver in there, that's really mostly 90% of that is federal agreements. So that's agreements with the Natural Resource Conservation Service or FSA, or we even have a research grant right now with the EPA to look at some of wetland mitigation issues.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A follow-up would be for either Ms. Kadelka or the director. There's been ongoing conversations at the Clean Water Council as to what portions of a number of expenses, at least from their perspective, whether it's Bowser or other subject areas, should be taken up by the LCCMR. Do you see any issues with continued support, or is there anyone suggesting that Clean Water Fund should do more or less at Bowser?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair and Representative, you know, our budget process, like other executive branch agencies, goes directly through what the governor recommends. And so as his budgets are coming out, I believe, later this month, of course, that's what we follow too. I've sat in on a couple of the Clean Water Council discussions this fall. And so they've really been looking at where do they want to go. They've created a strategic planning framework that talks a little bit about what some of their core goals and values and principles are. And so if this committee would be interested in that, I could get in touch with the Clean Water Council administrator and have him share the Clean Water Council's priorities with this committee.
I think we're going to be getting there at some point, members, where the Clean Water Council, the predictable track which has been set is that that appropriation would initiate here and then move to the Legacy Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just follow up.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is my final thought or question point. Just brought that up. The Clean Water Fund specifically, because I did hear a few opinions that they'd like to be making more monies available in other subject areas, and I would argue that this is a absolutely necessary and critical subject area for support. So just something to put on members' radar. Thank you.
Representative Backer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two comments and then the question. I would have to also follow Representative Heintzman's lead there too. In the ag industry, the ag has been tremendous with the buffer things. This is something that is, Director Drasky would know when this was introduced, there was a tremendous amount of resistance because land was taken and they have not been compensated for that. We're having 98% compliance. That's phenomenal. In the metro area, we could do buffers also because we have runoff on the lawns into the sewer, curb and gutter area. And there's probably less than 1%. That's constantly what I hear out in greater Minnesota. So when you take people's livelihood away from them without compensation and they have done what they can, considering the challenge that people had back in 2015, 2016, and to go this far in 5 years is phenomenal. It's no difference than if in the metro area someone went to widen a road, took your lawn away from you without the proper compensation. People in the metro suburban area, fellow Minnesotans, would be up in arms with. So I'm really disturbed when I hear these comments that, what are we doing with the other 2%? We need to look at what we've done well. The second thing I want to comment on, and this is maybe, and I'm not saying this is the intention of Bowser at all, because I know how Director Drasky and Angie works very hard, but the intention out there, I know we've heard quite a few times that everything's volunteer. What feedback I get, and not just in my area, but across the state, is if you don't do a certain way, you won't get the dollars. There is this unintended consequences. Again, I'm not implying anything. I'm here to create a win-win relationship. I've had a number of conversations with the director and Angie over the years, and we'll continue to do that. Because I'm like them, I want a win-win situation. But there has been those implied, I'm not saying directly, so I'm sharing that with that, even though it comes across as volunteer, if you don't do it a certain way. And sometimes it has to be done more from the local perspective because they know the area. And I know you guys have worked really hard. I am not here to poke you in your eye. I'm just sharing with you feedback that I've got. Now, my question is of your revenue that you guys bring in, what do you know the dollar amount that you guys use for the operation of Bowser? What that actual dollar amount is? That's the question that I have.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Dr. Jashke.
Mr. Chair and Representative Backer, we can get you a more detailed breakdown because it has different categories. I mean, obviously we have to have accountants and clerks and in addition to our hydrologists and engineers and biologists, to do the program work. There's a more detailed version of that that we either can present to the committee or we can just get you maybe more of a breakdown of a pie chart. If you prefer that, we'll make sure we get that to you. I don't have the numbers, off the top of my head, but it's of that 17%. Some is for program, some is for the administration, some is for building leases and vehicles and things you have to have to operate, right? But back to your earlier point, I don't get out much as anymore like I used to. And that was one of the best parts of the job, was seeing the results that people were getting out in the landscape. I did take two trips, one through your, you know, backyard, so to speak, this fall, and one further southwest. And, you know, without any evidence, you know, I drove two different routes both ways on the back roads. And I saw every single place I crossed a water course, there was a buffer. I was, like you said, I think we need to thank those landowners for doing that. You know, some of it was done through the public drainage system work, which is also really important, right? I know in your backyard, they've been doing a lot of conservation practices along with the buffers to make sure they're going to have a long-term resiliency in their infrastructure to manage that water moving through those landscapes. And so I couldn't agree with you more. You know, there's always a outlier here or there in anything we do. And we'll just work on that, you know, case by case. And the local officials are the ones responsible for that by and large. And you know, they're up to the job too. So we have full confidence that we've made a great deal of progress, and a little bit more to go will get done too.
Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, the ag industry has done well. If you could email me something, just a more detail on the budget operation, that would be much appreciated. Thank you, and thank you, Chair.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And real quickly before I ask my question about the CREP status, I'm just curious for the director or assistant director, seeing that Hennepin County is part of the 54 county that's covered under CREP, can you just give me an idea of the different projects that's happening in Hennepin County?
Yeah, maybe just Becker Kadelka can. Yeah, I'll have Assistant Director Becker Kadelka describe that. You know, Hennepin County, of course, has got a diverse landscape. You know, we've got a lot of rural area in the western part, and of course, the most urban part of the state. You know, in the other parts, and so we have projects that local governments have done in both of those types of landscapes within Hennepin County. The CREP program is a more rural area program, because you're taking, you know, marginal farmland of the cropping history and converting it back to a wetland or a buffer strip. But we can certainly give you some more examples of those projects in Hennepin County or any place else, honestly. But Ms. Becker-Kadelka, if you want to follow up, that would be appreciated.
Ms. Becker-Kadelka.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, I don't know that I have much more to add other than saying that the CREP requires a cropping history. So there needs to be a row crop, which is clear out in that western part of Hennepin County. But there are other programs that urban areas are particularly well suited for. And so some of the things that our urban local governments have been working on are how do we have more complete infiltration systems, more than maybe even just an average rain garden, but how might we look at a landscape level of blocks of green infrastructure and roofs, and how do we divert curb and gutter systems? And so those things are, I would say, more of our urban practices, knowing that concrete is less infiltration than anything else, right?
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have two questions related to the funding for the CREP program. The first one, knowing that we still have about $16.7 million to reach the state contribution of $175, can you give us an idea of how much that has leveraged us, the 158, the dedicated, have leveraged the state of Minnesota, and how much is left over for the federal funding?
Mr. Chair.
Becker Kadelka.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, thank you. Good question. So the $158 million includes not only the work for design work and easement processing, but the vast majority of that goes out for landowner payments as well. The leverage is more than one-to-one across all projects. Some of our wetland projects are over two-to-one in a federal match. And the other piece in this that we're trying to calculate, and we're using some federal statistics for, is that when those dollars come in for landowner payments, there's also dollars in there for local contractors and construction, and there's dollars in there for, you know, moving the dirt and making these projects that bring an additional local economic benefit. And I think that's something that has been harder to quantify, but we've got some information that has come in from the feds that I'd like to do, because that would be almost an additional on top of the actual straight cash to cash leverage. There has been that additional economic impact in local areas, local communities.
Representative Lee. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And last question. So can you give us an idea of regarding the timeline, what happens if the legislature don't fully fund the $16.7 million that's remaining? What if we only fund it partially, either through capital investment or other avenues?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Kadelka.
Thank you. And Representative Lee, that's an excellent question. So of that $158 million, each time we get a federal each time we get a state match, that unlocks that equivalent amount of proportional federal money that can go to landowners. So of that $158 million of state match, we talked with our easement staff last week to see what are the most up-to-date numbers. There is less than $10 million that has not been obligated yet. So that means that what they tell us is with one more sign up, so we're going to have our next sign up. Again, this is all landowners that have been working with their local soil and water districts who are interested in finding ways to take marginal land. They all get environmental benefit scores. So this is where some of that good high land crop land wouldn't score high enough for this particular CREP to even be considered. Once those scores come in, once those applications come in, one more sign up, and we think that $10 million is going to be more than spent. Our last sign up, for example, we had $20 million in applications. So with these resources, if we don't have other resources this year, we would have to shut down the program until which time the state would want to add that final amount of match.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a closing comment. I believe, you know, from what we have heard from the assistant director with the popularity of the bill, that there's a need here for the residents of the state of Minnesota, and I'll be glad to have this conversation further in the committee that I chair in capital investment. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Members, are there any other questions? I have one for Director Jashke and Ms. Becker-Kadelka, and that is, you know, our state is going through tremendous changes over time, and the world where we grew up, where you know, the landowner where you grew up on the farm, you owned the property around the farm, and it used to be that 160 or 320 or 640. But now I think in the state to the south of us, not to below us, but to the south of us, there have been some studies that up to 60% of the land that is farmed by people who don't own that property, or are not living on that land. So how does the voluntary conservation system reach people who are not the landowners, who are not living there, but are making land management decisions?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. I think the latest information I saw was that Minnesota on farmland in particular, you know, we were in the 50%, you know, above 50% anyway, of land that was being farmed by someone other than the fee title owner, right? So, you know, that presents both challenges and opportunities. You know, I think it can give people who have not thought about their land another reason to think about it, other than just an income stream. They can think about the, you know, conservation being a public good that they have some interest in, you know, but you got to find them, right? Because they may not be anywhere near that piece of property now that they hold control over. And so reaching them, and even in the era of cell phones, you know, you can't just find somebody anymore. You got to, you know, find somebody who can find somebody. And so the local delivery system is really the best way to accomplish that, because they're in the community. They can build that network. They're trusted. And so we think that's still the best way to solve these problems, is to have somebody local start the conversation with either the landowner, if not the landowner, the renter, if not the renter, somebody, a neighbor, and get that information flowing through and getting the idea of private lands and public goods coming together.
Ms. Becker-Kadelka? We're at two. If you would want to add, or are you?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and I think it's a really good question. And knowing that some of those absentee landowners may be living in other states, other areas, one of the things that our local government partners are exploring now, and one of the things we're working on in as we think about conservation and conservation marketing as we work on it together, is what is the best way to help people understand this difference between private land and public good? And it's something that takes more than just a flyer out there that says, hey, we've got this program. And so what we're learning is that it's not only reaching out to the absentee landowner, but it's reaching out to the renter and really working with the renter, because the absentee landowner is going to not only want to understand, but is going to most likely trust that renter in some of the information. And so it means that there's a lot more conversations that are out there, and it means that there's many layers of that work in order to help folks understand and to understand their motivations for how they might want to implement conservation on their land. Thank you.
Thank you, Bowser staff, and all the folks that extend our thank you to all the folks you work with and that work at Bowser for the work they do on the for the people of Minnesota. I would note that in today's bill introductions, there will be a CREP bill, bonding bill, that will be introduced. And of course, members are free to co-author that if they would like. I don't know the number yet. So with that, we'll move to the Science Museum. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And we have Allison Brown, President and CEO, and John Severson, Director of Strategic Partnerships and Government Relations here from the Science Museum. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Allison Rumble Brown, and it's a pleasure to be here with you today. I wish, of course, we could all be in person, and we look forward to when we can be. As Mr. Chair said, I'm the President and CEO of the Science Museum of Minnesota, and I'm joined by John Severson, our Director of Government Relations, and also by Barry Gisser, our Chief Financial Officer. It is my honor leading a storied and beloved Minnesota institution. And if you may not know, but this past Monday, January 11th, we celebrated our 114th year of serving this state and many beyond this state. And with your support and partnership, we look forward to the next 114 years. It will not be all under my leadership, of course. Each biennium, we are excited to share the great work and statewide impact of the Museum Science Education Equity Initiatives. Unfortunately, our state and nation's conditions dictate they open today on a more somber note, our current fiscal environment. The financial impact of COVID-19 is significant for the Science Museum of Minnesota and all of our colleagues in the art and culture sector, with both the personal implications of significant job losses along with major financial challenges to our institutions. Despite these challenges, the Science Museum stayed focused on serving our community in many powerful ways, from pivoting to deliver digital learning programs and experiences for parents, teachers, and students, and creating a safe, supportive physical learning hub right here in St. Paul and our students who are in real need. So, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the Science Museum is respectfully requesting consideration of an increased appropriation of $1.5 million per annum for fiscal years 2022 and 2023. While our financial position could warrant a much larger request, we are also really aware of the budget challenges facing our great state and the difficult decisions confronting all of you as lawmakers. Our hour of need here is as it is for many businesses and nonprofits throughout Minnesota. We ask for additional critical funding needing to ensure our institution's long-term sustainability. It's also working to be a responsive constituent and partner with the state of Minnesota. The Science Museum is facing significant financial challenges due to the pandemic. We started this year, in fact, in March of 2020, with 499 employees. We're now 60% fewer employees with 204 due to the pandemic. 158 of our employees are permanently laid off. 94 are suspended as we assess the long-term economic impact on our operations and ability to reopen certain services. And 44 employees are temporarily laid off due to the recent closure in December. even after the significant expense reductions or other costs, meaning non-payroll costs, we project we will have an operating loss of at least $15 million over the two-year period between March 2020, so when we closed last spring, and March 2022 due to the pandemic's direct and indirect impact. That's the two-year period. With the most recent required closure of our museum in December, we anticipate an additional $1 million loss in visitor-related revenues on top of the nearly $6 million budget deficit for this current fiscal year of 2020-2021. The Science Museum did receive a PPP loan of $4.5 million. Only a portion of that will be forgivable. We are pursuing all other options available to us for the recent state COVID appropriation that will go through Ramsey County and the December 2020 Consolidated Appropriations Act. We are very grateful for the relief we've already received. There is no other direct relief provided to nonprofits or museums at the state or federal level. Initial aid was appropriately directed to healthcare and emergency relief services, and subsequent relief efforts have focused on gyms, bars, and restaurants. Cultural institutions like the Science Museum waited as other priorities were addressed, but as major employer and economic driver, our moment of need is here, and it is real. 108,000 art and culture workers are currently out of work in our state. Normally, during a year, 23 million people attend arts and cultural activities. We ask for your support, not because it would be nice to have, but because our very existence may very well depend upon it. Our financial reserves are limited and will not sustain us through an extended closure without additional emergency funding and economic relief from government agencies and philanthropic support. And we are really working on that philanthropic support. Through all of this, we remain committed to our mission, vision, and values, and to the people of Minnesota for whom we exist to serve. We're also committed to helping to optimize against the learning loss almost all kids experienced during this past year. In December, the museum adopted the goal of creating free access to virtual experience for every elementary student in our state, free access to students and teachers and schools. To reach this goal, we're developing a suite of experiences ranging from a virtual omni-film visit to student self-guided explorations available at no cost to teachers and schools throughout the state through virtual programming. In October, the museum also launched a program we're calling Full STEM Ahead. It's an initiative to benefit at-risk youth in St. Paul's Promise neighborhood. And I'm sure many of you know STEM is science, technology, engineering, math. It's a partnership between St. Paul City School and our Kitty Anderson Youth Science Center. The museum opened its dormant education spaces to provide a safe, Wi-Fi enabled, opened part of the museum to a learning environment for kindergarten through eighth grade students identified at greatest risk for success in a virtual learning environment. The barriers to success are numerous for many of these families. They may not have internet access or have one or both parents out of the home and unable to support their young learners. It's been a great success. This was an unfunded initiative championed by our staff and ultimately supported by our board of trustees and numerous private and corporate partners with funding. I'm really proud of this work. It's an example of identifying a great need and Science Museum staff stepping up to provide resources and solutions all in an environment of scarcity. While we know the path to economic recovery and a return to normal will take time, we continue to press forward with the vital work of inspiring learning, informing policy, and improving lives, our fundamental mission. Supporting kindergarten through 12 STEM education throughout Minnesota is one of the Science Museum's core commitments and ongoing focuses. Our superpower is continuous innovation, steeped in research, teaching STEM topics in ways that spark and delight learners. The old way of teaching science, which is memorization and individual focused text-based learning, wasn't effective for many students. It's proven to leave many learners left out and disconnected. The Science Museum is building science literacy and addressing opportunity gaps by transforming how science is taught across the state, across the whole state, so that everyone, particularly focusing on girls, youth of color, and youth from low-income families, so they see themselves as scientists, even if they don't become one,
Our world needs science and science education now more than ever, and boy, has that pandemic shown us that. We at the Science Museum take great pride in our role and status as a statewide asset. For 7 consecutive years, Science Museum field trips, school outreach, and teacher professional development programs reached all 87 counties. The shutdown might have interrupted that, but I'm pleased to share that we have reached 81 out of 87 counties before we shut down in March. And we had reservations in place to complete our 8th consecutive year. Now, in the materials we sent to you ahead of time, we have maps and counties on pages 10 and 11 that shows what we were able to achieve in fiscal year 2019. We're still preparing the maps for fiscal year 2020, which ended in June. We'll share those with you when we have those ready. We were able to reach nearly 100,000 Minnesota students. Unfortunately, we had to close in March, and March through June is our busiest field trip season. We missed out on tens of thousands of experiences and memories that are so crucial to inspiring young minds. Once we couldn't, though, engage with students directly in the classroom or at our facility in St. Paul, we retooled the existing curriculum for online delivery and then began creating new content right away in April. Even before the pandemic, we saw increases in monthly online sessions originating from school-based programs like Google Classroom, Canvas, and Seesaw. After sweeping school building closures in March, there were dramatic increases in the number of school-based sessions online accessing our content as part of classroom activities. A conservative assessment of these engagements totaled over 38,300 for the year. At the museum, we actively share the excitement of science we do with the public through exhibits, beyond the scenes school collection tours, social media posts, online programs, and so much more. There were several notable highlights in the Science Museum Center for Research and Collections this year because at the Science Museum, we don't just view science, we do science. We named our first Barbara Brown Chair of Ornithology, which is the study of birds. Dr. Catherine Early joined the museum last fall and will expand the museum's biological research. The museum scientists conducted 26 field expeditions this year, with sites ranging across Minnesota from Modena to Calumet to Marine on St. Croix. St. Croix Water Research Station scientists processed over 4,000 water samples and investigated blue-green algal blooms in Minnesota's remote natural areas. With support from legacy funds, research and collections digitized over 13,000 objects, including Minnesota anthropology and biological collections, making this information available to classrooms and researchers around the world. The Science Museum continues to work intentionally with communities that are marginalized and underserved in STEM. The museum makes a difference, but our work is far from over. The local and national events of 2020 serve to heighten the need for science and education that centers equity throughout our work at the Science Museum. This work includes ongoing efforts to ensure that the museum is welcoming to visitors regardless of financial status or identity through the work we're doing internally. The museum is engaging directly with communities that are historically excluded from science, and the museum is working to build more equitable communities through some of our programs, the Kitty Anderson Youth Science Center and Ideal Center. In our shortened year, the museum was still able to welcome over 50,000 visitors through some programs where we provide access with significantly reduced pricing, as well as providing complimentary tickets through our work for equity and access teams. 15% of our visitors use these programs, and the use has been growing and will continue to grow. I'm pleased that tonight we'll be launching our Science is All of Us campaign. Part of this initiative will be centered around 4 key resident and traveling exhibits: our award-winning and newly updated exhibit, Race, Are We So Different?, the Smithsonian Institution's The Bias Inside Us, and Skin and Green Card Voices are 4 of those exhibits, but that's just part of this initiative. Through Science is All of Us, we will provide a platform to explore different aspects of race and identity through the context of science. I look forward to inviting all of you to view and participate in these experiences when we reopen, which we hope will be in early March. Museums and cultural institutions are an essential to our economy's health, and we need your support now more than ever to ensure we survive and thrive. visitors to cultural attractions drive economic ripple effects to other businesses, like restaurants, parking facilities, hotels, and communities throughout the state. In fact, throughout the state, 14% of labor is involved in arts and culture sector. Before the pandemic, almost 20% of the Science Museum visitors were from Greater Minnesota or out of state, which helped drive the whole state's economic growth. As the vaccine rolls out and the pent-up demand for travel is released, safely released, the Science Museum will be a destination for families and friends to have a shared experience. We will be part of a quick response rebuilding our economic viability. Thank you for your consideration of our request and your continued partnership with the Science Museum of Minnesota. Together, we can weather the challenges of this pandemic, serve our communities, and rebuild our economies. I look forward to questions and answers and having a conversation with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. President. Thank you, President Brown. I'm wondering, I don't see any questions yet, but I anticipate there will be some. If you could go over those numbers again from the beginning of just layoffs, suspensions, et cetera, and then how much funds are you running short and when do you need them? And then finally, you know, in the money that we provided, and I think some funds that were appropriated at the federal level, there was money for theaters and public events, public things like theaters. And I'm wondering if you qualify for any of those funds, either at the state and federal level. And then while you're working on that, I know that Representative Keeler has a question next. So Ms. Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, representatives. And I'll go over some of the figures. I know there's a lot of information in what I presented, a lot of data. I'll go over some of them. Maybe I'll turn it over to Barry Gisser, our CFO, to go over some of the information as well. So we started the year with 499 employees, and we're down to about 204 employees. 44 of the employees are on temporary leave at this point and are on furlough. And when we reopen, we'll come back as we reopen. 94 of our employees are on a status where we have to reassess, can we bring them back as we look at different business lines and different opportunities that we do and determine in the future, will they come back or not? And then the other, I think it was 158 have been permanently laid off. And then financially, we anticipate that we will have a deficit or a loss, operating loss, of $15 million from March 2020, which is when we closed, through March 2022. We anticipate that the pandemic will have a financial impact for a two-year period. And it will take that long for people to get comfortable coming back to settings with other people. There will be some people who are more comfortable coming back earlier, and it'll take a longer time for other people to get comfortable come back.
And then Mr. Gisser, on the eligibility for the theater type of aid.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's an excellent question. There are two elements of the appropriations bill.
Mr. Gisser, if you could just cite your name and who you're with.
Oh, I'm Barry Gisser, Chief Financial Officer of the Science Museum of Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are two elements of the Appropriations Act that passed in December that are relevant here, both being administered by the Small Business Administration. The first one is a second round of PPP, Paycheck Protection Program, loans that are forgivable depending on delivery of certain standards. And the second is what I think you're referring to, the shuttered stages provision for performing arts venues. Those are either or, so you may apply for one or the other of those. We are still determining eligibility, and we will proceed with one or the other of those provisions.
Thank you. Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Ms. Brown. You talked a little bit about
the virtual programming that you did for students across the state. And I love that. As somebody who's an advocate for education, what I do know is that our STEM program is just so much hands-on. You know, there's so much that you learn when you can actually do and work and feel with these things. But I love that you've come up with a creative way to reach out. I have two questions regarding that. One, when you say all students, are you including our early childhood and reaching out to daycares? I know that one of the things I hear in my community is our early childhood and daycare population are really missing out on some of those field trips and stuff that they typically do. My second question is, one thing we've learned in this virtual world in education is that it works really well. I serve a greater Minnesota community, and you know, my students, it's 3.5 hours to drive here to experience this. Are you planning on continuing to implement a virtual option moving forward, you know, as we learn some of these opportunities in this pandemic so that schools can have access to this in the future?
President Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Keeler. Two excellent questions. And the early childhood, we will first be working on these programs will be at the kindergarten through eighth grade level, and will not be, those programs will not be focused on early childhood. I do want to say we have programs already online for early childhood that have been, we put on our website and under the section called Learn. We had a wonderful exhibit called Wonder Years that we developed in partnership with the University of Minnesota and the Early Childhood Department, and that has some excellent materials in it, and we put some of those online. And we also have activities online for early childhood. And those are hands-on, because we agree with you. The hands-on is the best way to learn STEM. And those also use materials from home so that you don't need expensive materials. They're just purposely designed so you can use things that you have at home. But the focus of these virtual programs through our education department is K through 8. And then to your second is, will we continue with these online experiences? And the hands down answer, quick answer is yes. Our focus is to continue in person and online as we move forward.
Representative Keeler, follow up?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mrs. Brown.
Representative Becker Finn, and we will adjourn at 2:30. Representative Becker Finn.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. And sort of a follow-up after Representative Keeler's question, and really just want to thank whoever's idea it was to include the sort of science to go packets that at least in our suburban school district were went out with the meals, the meal pickup. So for our students, when you went to go pick up your meals for the week, you had an option to pick up a packet with some at-home science materials to bring those things home. So whoever's idea that was, as that being a mechanism to get those materials and those projects into the hands of our kids, I just want to thank you for that. I know that it was a nice surprise for a lot of families in our district to be able to access that during this time. So, and then just wanted to echo of was going to ask the same question as Representative Keeler. So I'm glad to hear that we're going to continue some of these programs in our rural areas now that we know that we can do it. Mm-hmm. Because I think that's really important that it's not just the kids that are within easy driving distance of the Science Museum who get to benefit from it. Thank you.
Members, or President Brown, do you have any response to Representative Becker Finn?
You're welcome, I would say. And I will pass your comment back on to our staff. And the creativity that's come out of this horrible pandemic is quite impressive for people. And I agree with you that the ability to not have to drive has also been something we hadn't thought about before. Is also highlighted, though, I know all of you are well aware of the problem of Wi-Fi access. And the Wi-Fi access is a problem actually within the Twin Cities as well as outside in the rural regions. So we would love to work with you on anything we can do to help mitigate that problem.
Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it just actually a quick comment, really more than a question. And it was came to mind because of the last couple of comments that were made. When my kids were young, we lived in the Bemidji area. And so we were members at the Headwaters Science Center. And being members there, we were also members at the St. Paul Science Museum, which was a really wonderful, perk, I guess. And so maybe a comment and a question. Love that that was, that partnership existed to be able to, share resources, because that lovely little Headwaters Science Museum in Bemidji had it was such a hub for families in that community. And so what a great resource. And then does that same kind of partnership exist with other community kind of science centers around the state?
President Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Akam. And we do have a lot of partnerships and we are growing our partnerships. We belong to something called the I can never get it right, Aztec, Alliance of Science Technology Centers. And I think it's the Alliance. We just call it Aztec within. And so by being partnered with that, then becoming a member of one, you actually can use your membership at every organization. And so that actually helps with that. So thank you. And and doing partnerships is just a wonderful way to help each other. And that's the great, and you find that within government too. Government entities help each other so that we don't all reinvent the wheel. And I agree with you.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, thank you, President Brown, and if you could extend your thanks to all of the employees of the Science Museum and your team for working through very difficult times. And the Science Museum is an essential asset to the state of Minnesota. Now more than ever, we need to be promoting science. That's the path forward and the path for the future. So thank you for your work. This committee will work with you to try to figure out how we make it through and how we can flourish afterwards. So extend our thanks to the people who work on behalf for the state of Minnesota. Members, we will be meeting next week on Tuesday and Thursday. We will be hearing last year's lands bill on Tuesday, and we will be hearing last year's dry cleaners agreement on Thursday in our efforts for moving forward. In addition, I have outside of my office the 2021 LCCMR recommendations if anyone would like to co-author that. So thank you all for your work. Peter, am I forgetting anything?
Mr. Chair, we'll also be doing an overview of the Department of Natural Resources on Tuesday as well.
Yes. And with that, stay safe. It's snowing out, and this meeting is adjourned.